This is CliffCentral.com.
You know that you've made an impact when Rolling Stone calls you the most revered jazz trumpeter of all time, not to mention one of the most important musicians of the 20th century. Miles Davis was a terrific American trumpet player, band leader, one of the most innovative, influential, and respected figures in the history of jazz. For decades, he was a leading figure in the various styles of jazz, combining rock music with jazz. He's credited with some of the biggest hits like Stella by Starlight, Smoke Gets in Your Eyes, It Never Entered My Mind. Even after his death in 1991, his legacy continues. Most recently, his nephew, who we're going to talk to in a minute, Vince Wilbin Jr., has kept his uncle's memory alive with the launch of Miles Davis, Birth of Cool, which is a new documentary that focuses on the legend. It'll be screened at the 21st Encounters South African International Documentary Festival, which runs from the 6th until 16th of June in Cape Town and Johannesburg. So just a few more days of that left. We're going to find out from Vince what that's all about. And that's coming up next. Miles Davis, man. Thabo Modisani used to get me excited about this. He gave me the album, A Kind of Blue, a long time ago, and that was the first introduction I had to Miles Davis, and it was absolutely beautiful from beginning to end. I cannot profess to be the most enlightened jazz connoisseur in the world, but I can tell you something. You know good when you hear it, and that's true with Miles Davis. So no surprise, really, that there's a brilliant documentary on the go now. The fact that it's happening here in South Africa is very exciting, and you can find out more if you attend the 21st Encounters South African International Documentary Festival. Well, he's here, sitting right next to me. Vince Wilbin Jr., how are you, sir?
Hey, how you doing, man?
Nice to see you.
Good to be here.
I'm very glad you could be here. First of all, congratulations on the documentary.
Thank you.
How is it doing, and what's the response been? You've done Cape Town already. You're doing Joburg now?
Yes, we're doing Joburg tonight. We had a special screening last night in Soweto.
Mm-hmm.
The response is overwhelming. You know, and each screening, each festival, it's different. You know, people, you have different responses. You know,
yeah.
From Africa, we've been to South Africa. We've been to as far as Sundance and all over the Toronto, you know.
So tell me about the documentary. So it's obviously about Miles Davis, your uncle, but what do you focus on in there, and what kind of new stuff have you been able to find, and what kind of stuff can people expect to see if they come to see the documentary?
Well, it shows an in-depth his life. It's no holds bar. It's you have the drug use.
Yeah.
You know, we touch a little bit on that. What kind of, you know, what made Miles Miles, you know, things that people didn't know, you know, his sensitivity, you know, it's what drove him, you know, so it moves around, it, like his career, you know? It's just quick.
How well did you get to spend time with him? How well did you know him during the course of his life? I mean, his fame was just enormous, and by the time, you know, you came along, because you're a young man compared to him. He was an old man by the time you came along, right? I mean, how much of your uncle did you actually get to know, and how much time did you get to spend with him?
I lived with Uncle Miles and Aaron, his youngest son, in Malibu. I played drums in his band for 5 years. So I was around him a lot. You know, I was around him as a kid. You know, I grew up in Chicago. So, and then I would spend summers with him in New York. So I was around him pretty much. Yeah.
And he was a controversial man. I mean, there was a lot that went on in his life. He didn't hold back when it came to saying what he felt about things. He was very outspoken.
Opinionated.
Big time. And a lot of people were very, they found that quite refreshing, because there were a lot of musicians from that era who didn't speak about, you know, some of the more political, some of the more controversial, some of the more difficult social issues.
Mm-hmm.
Miles never held back. He was very much, you know, offering and willing to give his opinion just about any time of the day.
Yeah, yeah. So you can imagine what my mom was like, his big sister, right? That's where I grew up. No, but you know, social change. He didn't want to play five sets a night. You know, you guys had to play 5-6 sets a night, and so he wanted to. He said, "No, we play 2 sets."
Yeah.
And then he caught a lot of flack for that early on in his career. You know, so things like that. You know.
And growing up during his time was very, very different to the way that musicians grow up now. And I mean, there are great musicians who don't have to deal with half the shit that Miles had to deal with when he was young.
Yeah, it's the racial equality, you mm-hmm. know, the
whole civil rights situation.
Man, yeah. The you know, in music, when you have to go by what the record company says you have to play, and they pick your songs and tell you what direction to go in. But with Miles, it was like directions of music by Miles Davis.
He told them what he wanted.
He wanted the can I say Bitches Brew?
Yeah, sure, of course, yeah.
When they found out that was the title, you know, the label was like, oh, this, you know, that's going to be the title of the record. And he said, no, I want Bitches Brew. He wanted his wife on the cover. He wanted black women on the cover of his records. You know, who does that? You know, they had a white woman on a sailboat for miles ahead the record because of marketing, and they thought it would reach a wider audience to have a, you know, a white woman in a sailboat and the good life.
And he said
like,
no.
Hell no. He's like, no.
Well, he also stood up for himself when it came to, you mentioned how he'd play two sets a night, but he didn't tolerate nonsense from the record company either. In a time where the record companies were God,
mm-hmm.
they would
mm-hmm.
set the rules.
Oh, yeah.
They told everybody what to do. They owned you.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody owned Miles.
No,
ever.
He told Clive Davis, he said, and this is in the documentary, not to give it away, he said, I want to play, you know, all these white-haired white boys playing rock. He said, I want to play those stadiums. Yeah. I want to get into that. You know, because in the States, and I don't, maybe it's around the world, but not now, but everything was categorized. You know, you know, you had jazz here, you had rock here, you had pop here. It was in hip hop back then, but
he
broke down the barriers.
Yeah, he didn't care about that.
No, he wanted to, you know, he called it social music. He hated the word jazz.
Yeah.
He thought jazz was like slavery.
You've set up quite a lot in the wake of Miles' death and his extraordinary career. You've set up quite a lot that can allow Miles Davis fans to appreciate the man
mm-hmm.
since his life ended. And I think that's tremendous. It's first of all a matter of great pride for your family, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it's also for fans all over the world. I mean, there are people who are obsessed with your uncle's music.
Yeah,
there are people who have listened to every single note in every album 1,000 times mm-hmm. and can't get enough.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's got to be something amazing to know that you had proximity to this guy, that you played with him, that you actually had the chance to get to talk to him, and now that you've made this documentary, it must make you feel really good that you've done some good deed for the world by showing us this side of him.
Well, what's amazing is he continues to touch the world. You know? I mean, it's, how many musicians do you know that play with Charlie Parker and Prince? You know, I was in a surf shop in South Africa, in Cape Town, right?
Yeah.
So my cousin Aaron is a surfer, Miles' youngest son, so he was buying surf merch. And the lady said, you know, he was on the other side of the store. She said, well, why are you guys here? You know, what's the big, you know, what why are you traveling here to Cape Town? So I'm thinking, she's not going to know who Miles Davis is. A young girl, right?
Yeah.
A young surfer, the owner of this surf shop. I said, I'm here. We're doing a documentary on Miles Davis. She said, Miles Davis. She jumped over the counter. She took
Oh,
pictures.
Wow.
I was like, you know, so you never know. You know, I mean, this man continues. He's been gone since September 28th, 1991. And he continues to touch lives. And it's amazing to me.
And the albums continue to sell, right?
Oh, yeah. We have a release coming out, In a Silent Way, remixed by Q-Tip from Tribe Called Quest. Mm. We have a Rubber Band Session coming out from Warner Rhino. We have the soundtrack for the documentary coming out in September. So it keeps coming. It's vaults of music, you know, of Miles' music.
And there's a lot of material.
Oh, huh? Long after we're gone.
Yeah.
You know? I love going in there and listening to that, you know, outtake tracks and things. It's like it's like, it's like Christmas.
and he used to lose his temper really often when people wouldn't do what he needed to do on a record, right?
Oh yeah.
Yeah, he got cross.
Yeah, he's the next musician. Yeah,
took
up.
It all very seriously.
Oh yeah.
There's no serious. Messing around.
He said no bullshit in the music.
Right.
Can I
Yeah, of course you can. Yeah. Now you can say bullshit.
No
here.
BS in the music. You know?
Yeah, you can. You
know, take it seriously. And that's what he instilled in Aaron and myself and all the musicians. I call it Miles Davis University.
And Aaron plays?
Aaron played electronic drums after I left the band. But Aaron was my drum roadie. You know, Aaron is younger than I. So when, you know, Uncle Miles wanted him to have that thing on the road.
And Miles' other kids?
They're one's deceased and one's in New York and Cheryl's in Vegas.
Okay.
Las Vegas.
And are they
retired.
Still involved at all in music?
No.
No. So it's just Cheryl,
Cheryl was the school teacher, scholar.
Right. Now, he has a history with South Africa as well, because he did some protest music, and he was very involved in the the fight, obviously, for South Africa and for people here and against South African, you know, the government at the time, and
played
for
on the
sanctions.
Sun City.
Yeah, that's right. So tell me about that.
I remember he played on. I remember when he did the recording, and when I was talking last night on the Q&A. You know, it. I kind of teared up because you have two records, Tutu and Amandla, right? Mm. And that was in 86 and 89, I think those were releases.
Mm-hmm.
And it just hit me, like, I'm here in South Africa, and those two records were released, and he was a very adamant and an advocate of social rights, you know? And so he would probably be like, yeah, you're here, Neff. He called me Neff, you know? And it's an honor to be here, man. And maybe that's why I cry so much.
Well, it's great.
It's sensitive. It's sensitive to me.
Yeah, of course. Know? And you're here to represent him. He never got to come to South Africa.
No. But he would have now. You know.
Of course.
I'm sure.
I mean, those efforts, I think he raised well over $1 million for the anti-apartheid movement. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We're trying to bring a band here. Miles Electric Band is my band, and it consists of guys that play with Miles. So I'm talking to promoters today about coming and playing, man.
So what does your day-to-day involve with respect to Miles and his legacy? Because you're very much the guy who's looking after all of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's Aaron and myself, but it's just, I have my career. I'm writing, and I have a studio at my home. So it just it's like a job, but it's not a job. It's like, it's fun. You know, it's like, okay. You get phone calls from the lawyers and the attorneys, and I mean, lawyers and attorneys. And
sure.
you know, you get the record people calling you, the labels calling you, and you just deal with it. You know, you get into a groove and you make it happen.
And this documentary is obviously going to be seen by Miles Davis fans and by people who didn't know much about Miles until they'll see this. And I think it's probably fair to say that you didn't make it sanitized. You didn't go and try to create some kind of fluff piece on Miles. And you know, he was an all-round great guy, never made any mistakes, didn't have a bad temper.
Now, you know, my other Uncle Vernon, who passed away, this Miles' younger brother, he said that my brother was no angel. He said F an angel, you know. So that kind of, like, you know, we're not proud of the abuse and the drug use, but I mean, it shows you that the man turned himself around, you know, for the betterment of the world. Does that sound corny?
Yeah, no, that's about, I mean,
but,
right.
But it's you want to show the sensitivity. You don't want to hide from the drugs and run from the drugs. And
he's
the abuse.
A real guy. He had real life problems, like everybody
does.
Right,
that's right.
I mean, a lot of music comes from pain, right?
Yeah. That's in the documentary.
Well, there we go.
Have you seen it?
But if you listen to the way he plays, now I'm going to them.
Please do.
If you listen to the way he plays.
You can hear it, right?
There's no way you could play a trumpet like that and not have some serious pain in your life.
That's what Quincy Jones said. And pain and happiness, too. You know?
Sure, of course. You've got to have both. You were very involved in the Don Cheadle movie,
mm-hmm.
right? You had some input there.
I chose Don to play Uncle Miles. And that was Don's directorial debut.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Great actor, huh?
He's a beautiful dude. He's a beautiful human being.
You were happy with that?
Yeah, I was. You know, we caught a lot of flack because people didn't like it. But it was Don's idea.
What did people not like?
Well, they didn't think it was. I guess they were there to see a documentary. But it wasn't. Don never wanted that. He wanted fiction, part fiction. Believe what you want to believe. And look at it that way. But I guess these diehard Miles fans wanted something different. They want the Birth of the Coup. But Herbie Hancock told me once, he said, hey man, this movie Miles Ahead was like if your uncle was having a dream. Mm. You know, it's like the, you know how you have dream, these weird dreams and things move around. So that's the premise I take on it. I loved it. I loved Don.
Miles did meet our own Hume Masekela, right?
Oh yeah. I met him backstage.
They knew each other quite well.
Yeah.
And they often, I mean, both being trumpet players, they would often collaborate in America when Hugh was over there.
I think Hugh Doug was one of his, you know, Uncle Miles was one of his, you know,
inspirations.
Heroes. Yeah,
sure,
yeah.
Of course.
And I met Hugh's son, Sal Masekela.
You know how big jazz music is in South Africa, right? Mm-hmm. We've got massive support for jazz here, and there's an enormous fan base.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of people appreciate the work that your uncle did to make jazz mainstream, because it was jazz was always something that first of all, it started off as a very popular thing and everybody was involved. But it did at some point reach a stage where it became a little elitist and only a certain crew of people listened to jazz. Mm-hmm. And your uncle's music made that mainstream again and allowed it to be popular. In this country, too, I think people are rediscovering that music and rediscovering albums like A Kind of Blue.
This is a guy I met a guy last night at the Q&A in Soweto told me the same. That record said it changed his life. And so it's like you can travel the world. You know, I keep repeating this, but it just amazes me. You know, I'm in Soweto. This guy says, "Hey, man, Kind of Blue changed my life." And I'm like, you know, and then the girl at the surf shop. You know, those moments, you know.
Are there stories that you have about your uncle that you haven't told yet? Or are there stories you put into this documentary that you were saving?
Yeah, I had a few scenes that I was really emotional in the documentary, but Stanley took it out. Mm-hmm. Stanley Nelson, the director.
Right.
But when I look at the doc, I've seen it like 12 times. It hits me. Each time I see it, it's different. I say, wow. And this is my uncle. And I'm like, wow, look at this. Look
it's
at
amazing.
That.
You're even discovering stuff about him.
Yeah, it's amazing, man. It was amazing for me to be around him, you know. This guy changed clothes 6 times a day. First one up, really. First one up in the morning, last one to go to sleep at night. And his mind, you know, just like, who does that? You know, and the energy, double Gemini, you know, the energy that he had. On the daily, swam. We went up to Pepperdine, it's a university in Malibu, so he swam. He'd come back and cook the most amazing dishes you ever want to eat.
I heard he was a good cook,
Oh,
no. Someone told me about that.
Yeah, like a master chef, bouillabaisse, anything. He would have not to give away some of his recipes, he would have fish. He would fry fish and put a little Jack Daniels in the batter. Back Ooh. Then, but you know, he didn't drink after a while. But
And the women loved him.
Oh, pasta.
There was no woman he couldn't have, right? There was no woman in the world he couldn't have.
No, he was women were attracted to him.
They loved him.
Yeah. And his wives, I was tight with Frances, who just passed away. She's in the documentary. His wife. And Cicely Tyson, we talk once a week.
Right.
You know, she's still doing her thing. And, you know, she's like a matriarch. I mean, I travel with her sometimes, and she's like, it's the same thing that Miles had. You know, when we go through airports, Cicely has the same thing. It's just like...
People just...
Yeah, they gravitate.
Yeah.
They have tears in their eyes when I'm walking.
Well, you have to be a pretty strong woman to have put up with the force of nature that was Miles Davis, right?
Yeah. And I was around when she took Uncle Miles to get his herbs, kicked him, you know, got him help off, you know, weaned him off the coke. And she cleaned out the entire townhouse, the brownstone, in New York. She changed it around.
What was his house like when you were spending time with him?
The dark side?
Yeah.
It was pretty dark. He had these drapes, velvet drapes. They were always
closed.
And it was hard. You know, and he would go and on his benches, and I would stay in the place by myself in the town, brownstone by myself. And I was afraid. I was afraid for him. Afraid
How old
myself.
Were you at this stage?
About 15.
Wow. It must have been tough. But when he was on a high and he was just a superhuman.
I called him superhero. I said, I want my superhero back. Yeah. See, you're saying a lot of things that are in the documentary, but this is you know what I mean? That's the way I was feeling. I said, I want my superhero back. You know, I said, Uncle Miles, don't go. You know, for a kid, it's like,
That's
and he's
hard.
Your uncle. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Shut up. I'll be back. And then he just kicked it. And then he wanted to make a record.
He went cold turkey, huh?
Yeah, a few times. Jeez. Off of heroin and then off the drugs, off the cocaine and the beer.
And you know, there's this weird relationship between so many great musicians and drugs. Mm-hmm. Because some of them are so creative on that stuff, whether it's, you know, the good stuff or the bad. Because people say, you know, these drugs are the bad ones and those ones are the good ones. But there are musicians who find a lot of inspiration because it triggers all kinds of imagination and they go into a state of euphoria and they can write stuff that we still look at today as being priceless. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But it's also the tough times that make them creative, right?
Yeah.
And with him, just such ups and downs, such extremes of emotion.
Well, like you said, it's his personality, the pains and the ups and the downs and the, you know, it's you can hear it in that trumpet, you know, when he puts that. You know, I've experienced on stage. I experienced that muted trumpet, and it's like it's hypnotic, you know. We all over the world, Japan, no matter where we were, you know, we had a set list, but the songs varied every night. You know, the same set list, but each song was different every night.
Did he ever get any shit from people because he had you in his band?
No, because I played my ass off. No.
Yeah,
you know, it wasn't nepotism.
He didn't let you
it wasn't nepotism. No,
if you didn't do something right, you were out.
My ass was gone. It was no nepotism, and I wasn't afraid because I was ready.
Yeah,
you know? It was a song called Human Nature, and the drummer didn't want to play it. So I was in the control room co-producing, and he said, come on out and play. I didn't even have time to think about it. I said, okay. Counted it off. We moved the other drums out.
Brought yours in.
Shit, I was ready. And you don't have time to get nervous. You know, that's what playing with him did to all of us.
Vince, did you ever speak to him about his legacy? Did you ever have a conversation with him where he explained to you how he felt about his contribution to music and humanity?
No, because he wasn't that kind of guy. You know, he never wanted to look back. One day we were traveling somewhere in Europe, in France, I think, and I had a Walkman, and I had a cassette of the quintet, the second quintet with Tony Williams, Herbie, Ron, and Wayne. And he said, give me that cassette, because he could hear it in my headphones, and he never gave it back. So I don't think he wanted to look back, and I never asked him about what was that like, you know.
And he never did any of that nostalgic stuff of listening to old albums or anything.
No, they weren't in the house.
Really? He didn't have his own music on?
No, not the old music.
Because you hear about a lot of these musicians and they're playing their own songs whenever they're trying to seduce a woman or whatever. Miles never had any of his own music around?
He used to have a good Prince on the phone. You know, like Moving Forward, Squiddy Politti, Mr. We were reaching out to those guys on the phone to record that kind of music. You know, MTV was big then. So he would have the sound turned down, and if it was something he liked, he'd turn it up.
But you know, unlike other musicians, he did get to experience the love and the respect of the music industry during his lifetime.
Oh, yeah.
Because there's some people who obviously they only get that when they're dead.
Yeah. No.
And he had a lot of that, right?
Yeah, and we would see like his older friends in the airport and backstage and at festivals and stuff, you know. So he would give them big hugs and, you know, it's so he didn't talk about it, but he would feel great when he would run into Max Roach or some guys backstage or Herbie or anybody that we were on the festivals with.
And the music business has changed so much since he died in 91. I mean, now, if you think about how music is sold and how little money there is in actually making the music, it's all in performances, right?
Yes.
And he did a lot of performances, but he probably would have been annoyed by the kinds of pressures that musicians are under now to make a career like he had.
Yeah, but
it's almost impossible.
I think that he still would have been leading us, you know, in some way. You know, I think that there's no record stores anymore, and especially in the United States. There are no music programs in the States and for kids and in some of these schools, you know, and so it's a different climate. You know, I used to like to go to a record store, read the albums, you know, read the covers. And then buy the albums. That's what my boys did. That was our, you know, that was our fun on a Saturday, riding the train downtown in Chicago and picking up a couple of albums and then coming back and critiquing them, you know. But can't do that anymore. You know, kids don't even listen to entire albums.
It's no, they don't.
They don't have albums.
They get like a
no
single.
No CDs, no albums. You know,
downloaded illegally. Somewhere.
Everything streamlined.
Where do you go for inspiration now? Because it's not as if music, all the good songs have been written. There are good songs coming out every day, but where do you go to find them?
I just search iTunes. I'm always like trying to find some
new
music.
You have friends who also suggest
I got DJs. I call DJs up, you know, because they know all the music.
Yeah.
Q-Tip and all my buddies, you know. I call Q-Tip because Q-Tip is... He's a bad cat. You know you've Tribe Called Quest, right?
No, of course.
And Cats from the Roots.
Do you think Miles would have collaborated with those guys if he were around today?
Definitely.
Yeah,
Q-Tip and Tribe Called Quest.
electronic dance music and hip hop.
Oh,
and,
man. Yeah. Hell yeah. Kanye and,
yeah.
And U2 and Foo Fighters and, you know, yeah, man. Who's to say, you know? I'm sure that he would have.
It's so interesting that he was one of these people who broke down all those barriers between the genres, because I've always maintained, and I hope you'll back me up on this, great music isn't about the genre. That's only important to the person who puts the records in the store.
Right.
I have to put them in categories.
Right.
Anybody who loves a song, you could hear a melody, you could hear a beat, you could hear some part of a song that you just love, and it doesn't matter what genre it comes from, right?
Not at all.
Good music is great.
We've got a few tunes. We have a song with Lettucey. We have a song with Layla Hathaway, Donny Hathaway's daughter, coming out. So it's like, we probably catch flack for that, but...
So what?
Yeah. I'm happy.
But
I'm proud.
The purists, there are purists.
We got it from miles ahead. People hated it.
But these purists, they're also the people who put Miles on a pedestal. They wanted to see him as being like a saint.
Mm-hmm.
He's in their pantheon of gods, right?
Mm-hmm.
And these jazz purists, they're the ones who expect you to evangelize their version of Miles, even if you knew other things about him.
You know, my dad, when I was a kid, my dad had friends who liked the electric Miles and the acoustic Miles. So down in the basement, they had a couple of couple of shots. They would argue.
Yeah.
And my dad would end the argument and say, hey, this is my damn house. This is my turntable. I'm going to play what I want to play. So that ended the electric acoustic argument.
Well, you know. I want to let everybody know that they can go and see the documentary. It is on at the 21st Encounters South African International Documentary Festival. It runs from the 6th to the 16th of June. So we only got a few days left over that in Johannesburg. You could probably meet Vince there. You're gonna going around meeting people?
I'm there. Come on out.
Wow, man. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you, man. Thanks for having me.
You got some of Miles in you, man.
That's what they say.
Yeah, you do.
That's what they say.
It must be quite something. Like, were you his favorite nephew?
I hope so.
I'm sure you are now. The documentary is great. It is. It's really worth checking out. I've heard from everybody who's seen it, and we have the producer, the visionary, the innovator, the originator, the guy who came up with this. He's Vince Wilbin Jr., and you can find out more by going to see the documentary at that festival. Awesome.
Peace.
Thank you, sir.
Peace.
What a pleasure to see you.
Thank you.
Thanks
for having me.
This is CliffCentral.com.